Zane, and I represent Mr. Carter, and I'll try not to get into this, Judge Petty. I was thinking about Judge Cundiff's funeral and what you said, that if he could have risen up from the coffin, he would have probably said, "You said that already, now move on."
Yeah.
And so I'll try not to do that today. But the this was an unusual case to try, dominated by the issue of the tapes and everyone's high interest in the tapes, and sometimes it was hard to get past that. But the first and I think the biggest problem in the case is the statement from Ms. Moynihan. And she said that she was so disturbed in talking to the daughter the night before that she actually drove to my client's work to tell him about what she had said. And my client was not upset, but he said that, you know, don't worry about it. You know how she is. You know basically how emotional she is.
But I thought the record reflected that the threat was not communicated to your client.
She didn't. She didn't communicate the threat, but she was just communicating that she was upset about the tapes. She didn't say anything about the threat, but she was disturbed enough by it that she went over and talked to my client that evening at work. The mother did. And my client goes the next day, as soon as he gets off work the next morning, goes home, goes to sleep, and goes over. And then immediately, according to him, she pulls a pistol out, and when he tries to knock it from her hand, the gun's discharged.
Well, counsel, then, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Your first assignment of error regarding the threat to kill came about as a result of Ms. Moynihan not being present in court to testify that the decedent made that threat to her. Is that right? The next morning, and you asked for a continuance.
Yes, and you know, we didn't, and I keep saying this over and over, we really need court reporters. The legislature really needs to make sure that we have court reporters at all times in these cases. There have been some discussions back in the judge's chambers, and if you look at the questioning, I start to get into this with Ms. Moynihan, and the judge says something to the effect of, this has been discussed, this is not the time to bring it up. And it was my anticipation that we would call her the next day to get into that. She goes to the hospital. We move for a continuance based on that. Yes.
Okay. And then the proffer was not renewed. You had a proffer for testimony, and you did not renew that after your client testified. Is that right, when self-defense became an issue in the case?
I'd made the proffer, and I believe that it was understood. I'd made the statement that we would make the proffer, and I believe it was understood that we would do that at the conclusion of the trial. And that's how it played out in this case. Yes, I did not renew it because I thought it was well understood, and by the record, it seems to have been well understood.
But, you know, following up on Judge O'Brien's question, at the time the court made its ruling that the evidence was not admissible, there was no evidence before the jury of self-defense. Is that correct?
The initial ruling, yes.
And then you never, after your client testified in and injected the element of self-defense in the claim, you never again offered that testimony, asked the judge to admit that testimony.
Your Honor, I believe we did. And I believe that
when was that done? Were there two rulings by the trial court that the evidence was inadmissible, or just
yes,
the
Your
initial
Honor.
One?
We actually went back into the judge's chambers,
but that's not in the record.
But it's not in the record.
All right, thank you.
I agree with you on that, but I think it's reflected in the record.
How does the evidence of the threat get to the issue of self-defense if it was never communicated to your client? Because of self-defense and that threat, it would be the effect it would have on him. But if it's not communicated to him, how does that help? How does that assist in the self-defense theory?
Because who was the aggressor is always an element that's important in a self-defense case, and it can be proven in a variety of ways. And we say that...
So you're relying on it for the
proof
evidence
of
who was the aggressor, not its effect on your client.
Not its effect on my client. And Judge Gamble continued to go back to the issue of the effect on my client, and I kept saying that it's really the proof of who was the aggressor. So we think that it's pertinent because it is so close in time, I don't know how it could be much closer. The threat's communicated while he's at work. He goes home, lays down, goes to sleep, goes over there immediately, and then all this happens.
What about the contention that the threat wasn't really a threat to kill, but merely that he was romantically unreliable, I think were the words that were used, and said he's not going to be around anymore?
But the romance in this case, at this point, was with the daughter and him, not with the mother and him. So I think that
that's sort of on how you define romance. You certainly was involved
Lord.
With the mother at least.
I know. I agree with you on that. But I do think that it's just a fair thing for the jury to be able to think about, because it's up to them to decide whether that's important or not after having seen all these people. And they may decide that it's terribly important and that it was a vital piece of this case. But they should be the ones to hear it and decide whether they rely upon it or not.
Let me skip for a second, if I may, to your second assignment of error about the exclusion of some of the prior acts of violence.
Yes.
The jury was permitted to hear about some recent acts of violence.
Some.
And isn't that really a discretionary call for the judge to make in terms of how far back and against whom any prior acts of violence can be admitted?
I think it is discretion, but I think it's subject to a reasonableness test. And I think if he says that it's going to be from this point forward, then it has to be from that point forward. I don't think you can pick and choose in that.
Okay.
And I think he did there.
Then
lastly, just to touch on my third point before I sit down, I've never had a case, every time I do these cases, I think I've seen everything and you see something new all the time. But the uncle who was mildly mentally retarded, At the beginning of the case, there was a lot of trouble getting him served, and ultimately a process server served him shortly before the trial. The morning of the case, the case was called, and the prosecutors knew he wasn't there and had been served. Again, Judge Petty, going back to court reporter, judge's chambers, and all of this, we go back there. We come out. We sent the sheriff to pick him up because we found out back there where the prosecutor believed he was. And in fact, he was there with another family member. He comes to court. He comes back the second day of the trial on time that day. And when he testified, he seemed to act like...
Well, the proffer that you made of this witness's testimony occurred after the case had been submitted to the jury, did it not?
And while they deliberated.
Hasn't the Supreme Court said that a proffer that is made after the case is submitted to a jury is too late because the trial courts can't consider it? There's
yes.
nothing the trial court can do?
Judge, I agree with you on that. They've said that. But I don't think anybody ever thought about a witness giving the proffer while the jury was deliberating and saying, I was untruthful.
Well, isn't really that the remedy when that situation occurs, a motion for a new trial, and that wasn't made.
I made a motion for a mistrial, essentially.
But you didn't make a motion for a mistrial. You say essentially, but you didn't actually say I want a mistrial.
Set aside the verdict as being contrary to the law and the evidence.
But I failed to see how the trial judge could have agreed with you at that point, even if he said, "Why, I do believe this testimony is relevant. I think this proffer makes it admissible." What could he do in terms of presenting that to the jury?
He couldn't do anything in terms of presenting it to the jury.
So it was to do is make a motion to set aside the verdict for a new trial.
But there had been no verdict.
Motion for a mistrial.
There had been no verdict at that point. And so, you know, and frankly, Judge Petty, if my imagination failed me there, it was just something that I'd never consider. What do you do while the jury's deliberating?
But wouldn't it be at that point you'd ask for the motion for a mistrial?
Because there's no verdict?
Because there's no verdict, yeah.
Probably be the better way to do it in reflection. But I did make a motion as...
Okay, I'm sorry.
I agree with you.
Well, when a witness recants, how at that point is the trial court supposed to know whether the recantation is true or the recantation part where he's claiming that he lied during the course of trial?
I don't think they could possibly discern that.
How does the case, the car pitcher case, not control in this?
Well, I just think that the jury needs to hear it all. That's my point. So, thank you.
Whose witness was Mr. Showalter?
Mine.
Wouldn't you, in effect, be impeaching your own witness?
I didn't ask for him to be declared an adverse witness.
But wouldn't that be the net effect of if this testimony was somehow presented, that you would be impeaching your own witness?
I did have to vouch for his testimony when he testified, but I think under the circumstances and the extreme nature of his denial and the contrary evidence, I think that the ends of justice would require we do something different.
Thank you, Mr. Stenzo. And you still have some, not quite all, but a good portion of your reserved time.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Baumgartner?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Office of the Attorney General. Your Honors, the first thing I'd like to mention was just that interwoven in Mr. Sansone's argument was frequently comments about things that happened that weren't in the record. Those potential conversations, potential discussions that were had in chambers are simply not before this Court. There are various ways of inserting those into the record. If they were relevant, that has not been done. So this Court can only consider what is actually in the record. And what is in the record on the first issue regarding the decedent's statement to her mother is essentially find yourself another man because this one wasn't going to be around long. It was not he's going to be not around after a specific point. It was that he wasn't going to be around long. This was made by the decedent who had just recently discovered videos showing the defendant, her boyfriend, the father of her child, having sexual dalliances with multiple women, including her mother and her sister. That is not sufficiently connected to the crime in time, place, or circumstance. It shows no design to hurt the defendant. It shows no intent to do anything to the defendant.
So it's your argument, regardless of when this evidence was proffered or when the witness would have been asked it, it would not have been admissible?
Correct. Now, I don't believe it was proffered at the correct time because it was never reproffered after the defendant testified. Moreover, there was a later proffer made after the jury was deliberating by the victim's sister, which was basically double hearsay of, I heard my mom say my sister said this. And that was a more ominous statement about how the defendant wouldn't be around, I think, after tomorrow. That is not the proffer, however, that the judge was deciding upon. So even if this proffer had been made after the defendant had raised self-defense as an issue about how the defendant wasn't going to be around long, that's simply not a threat. It's not sufficient to really show how the victim would have acted during that last confrontation. Now, regarding the regarding the acts of violence allegedly committed by the victim, I think it's very careful to read the actual proffer that was made. There is a chart in the brief, which I don't think is accurate as far as what was made. Any acts of violence from, I believe, 2012 on between the victim and the defendant were permitted in. Additionally, acts of violence witnessed by the defendant between the victim and her uncle, Mr. Showalter, from 2012 on were permitted in. What was denied then was a 10-year-old incident where the victim was bailed out of jail by the defendant, and she told him that she stabbed her sister's fiancé because he had hit her sister. That was too remote in time. It was a different type of relationship, and it was a different motivation. Once again, it was not connected in time, place, and circumstance. Similarly, the August or September of 2013 incident where the victim supposedly broke her mother's jaw, was also a different type of relationship. There's an unknown motive or circumstance because the defendant didn't witness this and he didn't know exactly what happened. Interestingly, it was never proffered as something the mother was going to testify about. And finally, the third item that was disallowed was the defendant's claim that the victim first hit him in 2008 or 2009 when she punched him in the face and he hit her back. That also was remote in time and a different character. The court is permitted to balance what comes in, and the court clearly did balance what comes in here. There is a careful balance of not permitting everything in wholeheartedly, as though there's an argument that somehow the victim, because of her own bad character, deserved to die. There is a balance to be made here, what is relevant to the jury. And I believe what was entered in was what was relevant and certainly not an abuse of discretion. Further, any error in precluding this evidence was harmless. There was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. There were two ear witnesses, so there was no question of ID. This was a planned crime. The victim was shot at home in her bedroom within 5 minutes of the defendant arriving. He had promised her mother the night before he was going to make this video situation okay. This was how he made it okay. And he took the gun there. He stole property, the phone, and the laptop, and he confessed repeatedly after he did it to the victim's mother, to the victim's sister, to his boss. Then he got on the stand and told the jury this unlikely and ever-changing story. Somehow, without ever touching the gun, she was pointing it at him, and she got shot by her own hand, center mass, through her aorta, through both lungs, through her spinal column. And he told all these different stories of how that happened. Maybe he pushed her hand. Maybe he had his hand on her hand. Maybe she was twisting. Maybe it was going up in the air. The jury was able to hear all of these stories, and also his story that he also placed her between him and the door, when the physical evidence was that she was at the window and he was by the door. Based on all of this evidence, the jury had absolutely no question. They had evidence that whether or not she said anything the day before, he shot her in cold blood when he did, and his lying about it was further evidence of his guilt. And the evidence that was excluded had minimal value compared to the evidence that was admitted about the violence in their relationship. If there are no questions about those two assignments of error, I'll move on to the last one, which is that the trial court did not err in refusing to set aside the verdict. I think Your Honors understand my position here based on your questions. This simply wasn't a timely request. One thing I would like to further talk about, though, is that Mr. Showalter was a defense witness. He was a defense witness who was called largely as a gamble. He had not spoken to Mr. Sanzone based on his testimony from the stand beforehand. And when he was later recalled after the jury was deliberating, he was asked further questions, different questions, and he gave different answers. A party to a lawsuit, much less a criminal case, can't simply be allowed to call a witness, ask them one question, one set of questions at one point, ask them a different set of questions at a different point, and then say, well, let's set aside the verdict because of that. That's approbate, reprobate for trying to set aside a verdict based on not liking their own witnesses' answers. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you very much. Ms. Sanzone?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't agree with the recitation of what the evidence was concerning the overwhelming nature of the evidence. The boys that were there at the house, the one boy that testified, said my client brought nothing with him, and the only thing he left with was a computer. And I think that's good evidence of the fact that he did not have the gun, that the gun was somewhere back in her bedroom. The evidence is he was there for a short period of time. And I do think that it's important that the jury heard what she had to say about her intentions. The last thing that's not really so clear from all of this, but it's pretty clear if you read the entire record, is that there is no definitive description of him as the man in the videos. This was a claim that was put forward by Squirt, who was the boyfriend, and of the sister, who was stirring things up from day one. And my client, you know, didn't discount the fact that he'd had relationships, but there are a lot of other issues about exactly what those tapes showed. And of course, they are such powerful evidence. But the evidence in this case is not nearly so overwhelming as stated. And I do agree, I did not say that the witness was an adverse witness, but I think I pointed to circumstances of him having to be arrested and brought to trial that puts you in a circumstance where it's pretty easy to see what his real relationship was here. But going back once again to the issue of the allowance of the evidence of their violent nature, there can't be a distinction in a case like this that, oh, because it was the mother that got her jaw broken and not some other person, and we don't know why she broke the mother's jaw, and that somehow is important to his understanding of whether she has a violent and turbulent nature. That's the purpose of that testimony, to show that a person has a violent and turbulent nature. And that was one of the most severe injuries she had inflicted upon anyone else. That was an injury that was known to my client. And we say that the circumstances of that, had they been revealed, of course the mother was in the hospital.
Do you agree that there comes a point when a prior act of violence like that is too remote in time to be relevant to the trial?
I do agree, Judge Petty. But
so this is a 10-year-old conviction, is it not?
No.
That one wasn't even a conviction. That one was the...
I'm sorry, I'm talking about the malicious wounding conviction.
The one against Squirt, who was the one that was stirring it all up. I agree that sometimes it's too remote, but I think what was said in Barnes is instructive here. Although the jury might have concluded that the evidence of the decedent's turbulent nature 5 years before was too remote, it might have determined that his aggressive tendencies surfaced whenever he drank to excess.
But in Barnes, didn't the trial court exclude all evidence of the defendant's prior violent nature when he had been drinking?
Yes.
And in this case, the court allowed some evidence of the decedent's prior violent nature.
Yes. But I think that makes this case more problematic for the Commonwealth rather than less. Because first of all, on the issue of remoteness, which is what I was addressing with Barnes and what Judge Petty had mentioned, they said that both of those issues are within the province of the jury and how they should treat it. And then once you start letting it in, once you say, okay, I'm going to give you all of the evidence for that 2-year period and then limit it again, I think that's a problem that can't be contained in a case such as this. So for those reasons, we would ask you to grant my client's appeal in this case and to allow us a new trial of this unusual case.
Thank you very much. We agree.